reaction we're beginning today is the Wittig reaction. It is one of two main carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions that you're going to learn this quarter. There are going to be some others, but this is an awfully important one. There's a major difference between the two reactions. Grignard reaction produces an alcohol, but from an alcohol, we could then convert that into an alkene. So sometimes a Grignard reaction can be used in combination with elimination or dehydration to add to a carbon chain through a carbonyl, but end up with an alkene. As you'll see, though, because it involves dehydration or elimination, there are some regiochemical concerns that might be there. The Wittig reaction is a very specific reaction that forms a carbon-carbon double bond. And it forms it only in the place where the carbonyl originates. And so in terms of regiochemistry, it's much more a specific reaction. Although we're going to see that there might be some stereochemical concerns. So first let me review the Grignard reaction, since we are going to be doing a Grignard reaction in lab at some point. And I'm doing this so we can contrast it synthetically with what the Wittig reaction gets us. Starting with a ketone or aldehyde, I can react this with an organometallic reagent, which the classic reagent used in Grignard reactions is an alkyl magnesium halide. You might recall that that ends up acting as if it was an anion, so this would be effectively a methyl anion, yes. Actually, for any of the rest of the labs this quarter, there's so much correspondence between the lab and the lecture, I'm going to declare anything that is not directly related to the exact lab that you're doing is lecture notes. Because Grignard reaction, that's a lecture topic. Wittig reaction, that's a lecture topic. When I flip over to talking about the specific reagents we're using in this lab, then that'll be lab lecture notes. And I'll go over specifically the form of the Wittig reaction that we're doing here, because we're actually doing a kind of a special Wittig reaction. We're using a more easily manipulable reagent than sometimes we find in these reactions. So first part's lecture, and then the next part would be lab. All right, so this methyl magnesium bromide acts as if it's a methyl anion. That methyl anion will attack the carbonyl carbon, pushing that open, making an alkoxide. Which after acid workup would then give us the alcohol. At least if we did a gentle acid workup. Because if we did use heat in the presence of acid, we could cause a dehydration reaction. Now notice the product that I've shown, since this is a reaction that involves heat, it's thermodynamics that are going to control the product that ends up getting formed. And the more substituents, the more alkyl groups we have on the alkene, the more stable the compound is. But you might recall from last quarter that there's a way to influence the regiochemistry of where this double bond ends up. In other words, there's a way to make this double form not to the most favorable position, to make something that's not the thermodynamically most stable product. And to do that, we end up making it difficult for the elimination to occur. So, in other words, if I were to take this same alcohol that we just formed above, turn it into a leaving group, for example, by using tosyl chloride, then I could do an elimination. If I used potassium T-butoxide, there is enough steric hindrance from the base itself that it makes it more difficult for the base to approach the compound and react. Particularly if we were to drop the temperature. At lower temperatures, only those reactions that have lower activation energies, lower barriers to reactions, are going to be the ones that are likely to occur. And so you can imagine that that bulky base there, which it's kind of deceptive the way I write it, that little cross sign makes it look kind of like a compact molecule. But if you actually built a molecular model for that and saw all the hydrogens, and if you actually had space-filling models, you'd see there's a lot of shielding in the way there. So that base would more easily approach a primary position than going for the tertiary hydrogen that, yes, if you remove that tertiary hydrogen, it makes a more substituted alkene. But in other words, you can make it where kinetics has the greater control. So I know I must have mentioned this idea that we're going to have kinetic versus thermodynamic control, and we will have a big long lecture on that. And in fact, because this class isn't as behind, but we're overall a little bit off pace where I'd like to be in lecture. And so I think scheduled in lecture is the topic, kinetics versus thermodynamics. But I'm just letting you know that when we get to the lab experiment, that's where really we're going to talk about this topic, and it's going to be a big, long lecture. So I'm going to be a bit brief here, but I do want to write down something about this elimination, just because I know we're going to be doing more synthesis problems, and you should know that you could influence stereochemistry this way. So the type of elimination, again, that we saw first, where we dehydrated, that made the thermodynamic product. And that form of elimination is often referred to as Zaitsev elimination. And again, it's the situation where you make the most substituted alkene because that has the most hyperconjugation with the surrounding substituents, which stabilizes the pi bond, which makes it a more favorable compound. This other product, this would be the kinetic product. And you could call it anti-Zaitsev, doing the opposite of the least favorable, but this is also sometimes called Hoffman elimination. Hoffman elimination is actually a specific reaction, but generalizing, sometimes that's what this is called. And I'll say again what I did just a minute ago as far as how would kinetics influence this. And again, it's that at low temperatures, only those reactions with lower activation barriers are going to be more favorable. And this is true even if the products that result are not the most thermodynamically favorable. When a large, bulky base is used in eliminations, the steric hindrance caused by that base can result in the elimination of the formation of a less substituted alkene. Now, in this particular example, we were able to end up with a specific product that had a terminal alkene. But you notice that there's a bit of symmetry to this molecule because I've got two methyl groups after the Grignard reaction, two methyl groups attached to a common carbon. So elimination, if it wasn't going to be to the interior, if it went to either of the methyl groups, you're going to get exactly the same product out. We could imagine that you'd have a situation where elimination might make potentially three different products. And so there could be situations in which it might be difficult by just elimination to arrive at just one product. Well, that's where the Wittig reaction comes in, because the Wittig reaction only occurs at one specific place where the carbonyl is. And other than making the reagent itself, it's otherwise a one-step process. So let me show you the Wittig reaction now. Gesundheit. Before I do that, there's a reagent involved that has multiple benzene rings in it. And it gets really inconvenient to have to draw the full structure out. So when benzene is treated as a substituent, it has the name phenyl, which we might have encountered last quarter. Phenyl group, when you're writing it, is very frequently abbreviated pH, which is even further abbreviated by using the Greek letter phi, pH. The reagent that's involved here that we use to make a Wittig reagent is triphenylphosphine. Which, if you did look over your reaction for you today, you might realize we're not doing this reaction. Let me show you the mechanism first, then I'll comment on it. Phosphorus being lower than nitrogen on the periodic table is even more nucleophilic than nitrogen because phosphorus is a squishier atom. That's our official term we used for it, the scientific term. Squishier meaning that the electron density can be more easily displaced, which means it more easily begins the process of bond formation. And so even though phosphorus may not be as basic as nitrogen, it's more nucleophilic. So this undergoes a very easy SN2 reaction to make a type of intermediate called a tetraalkylphosphonium salt. The reason that we're not doing this reaction, besides the fact that it's just one more reaction step we'd have to do, is triphenylphosphine is a neurotoxin. And given the way that chemicals are often thrown around, the balances and such around the room, I don't think it'd be such a great idea for me to give you all a bottle of neurotoxin to play with. So, after this, there is a deprotonation step that we perform, which, another side story, you're probably most familiar with tert-butyl and sec-butyl and isobutyl in terms of putting some kind of prefix before the word butyl. And we might have seen this, but we probably didn't talk about it much, this N-butyl designation. What I'm referring to is the compound N-butyl lithium. That's the way it's very frequently written. N, in this case, means normal, which means unbranched. So if you have tert-butyl, isobutyl, sec-butyl, all those different butyls, the N means none of those. It means just a regular four-carbon straight chain. So N-butyl lithium would be this compound. Acts much like a Grignard reagent. We'll talk about the differences between some of these different organometallic reagents after the exam. But like a Grignard reagent, this acts very much like an anion. And carb anions are incredibly, or like I used to say, hella basic. So if we have something like this salt, it's going to be relatively, yeah, I know, I don't say hella anymore because it just makes people look at me funny when I do that. Just like one time, way back when I was much younger, I did an impersonation of Cartman from South Park, but I must have said it just right that one day because I heard this sort of noise behind me as I was lecturing. I turned around, the poor person that was sitting in front, she couldn't talk because she was laughing so hard because she didn't expect her geeky chem instructor to start quoting South Park in class. So, anyways. This compound, relatively easy to deprotonate. Why? Easier than a regular alkane because you've got a positive charge right next door. So even though this might not be the most electronegative element that there is, because we've got that positive charge, makes it a little easier for a neighboring negative charge to form. I say a little bit easier because we are still using this awfully strong base to deprotonate. This is the other reason that we're not doing this reaction, because you can buy butyl lithium just in a reagent bottle. It's a very common reagent, but very, very reactive. Has the potential for causing serious burns if you were to get it on you. So, the intermediate, however, that's formed is kind of an interesting critter. Because if you're following the octet rule, we would have to write this compound as a double ion. And in fact, there's two terms we could use to refer to this kind of compound. A more general term that usually comes up when we're talking about amino acids is the term zwitterion, which means twin ion. And the reason that this comes up with amino acids is if you're not familiar with what an amino acid is, it's a difunctional molecule. It's what makes up proteins through amide connections that we're going to learn about in Chem 12C. Well, an amino acid has an amino group, which is a nitrogen group, which is a base, and an acid, a carboxylic acid, which is acidic. So even if you just had a solution of an amino acid and nothing else, it can react with its own self because it's got both acidic and basic functionality. And if that were to happen, the base would get protonated, the acid would get deprotonated, you get a negative charge and a positive charge next to each other, well, not next to each other, on the same molecule, and that's why it's called zwitterion. This is an even more particular kind because in this case you really do have the positive and negative charges right next door to each other. Now, many times when you're talking about a carbocation, you'll refer to it with an ill ending, like we might say methyl carbocation, or benzyl carbocation. So ill is there. And many compounds that have a negative charge, you have the ending ide on. Think chloride, bromide, oxide, nitride. I'm telling you that so you can remember that these kinds of compounds are often called illids or illides. Positive, negative, right next door to each other. Phosphorus, because it's on the third row of the periodic table, is able to violate the octet rule. And that's because of some complicated orbital interaction. In Chem 1A, we usually lie and say it has something to do with d orbitals, but it's not really quite that simple. But point is, we could write this as a different resonance form where we explicitly show a double bond. Some texts tend to always write that in a mechanism, but I always come back to the point that these two structures are really the same thing because this is just resonance. So it doesn't really matter which one of these structures we use. Sometimes it's just shown, though, to highlight the fact that this is a somewhat delocalized ion. So what happens next? Because all we've done so far is make the Wittig reagent. Well, throw it at a ketone or an aldehyde, that'll react with a carbonyl. Because if you have a negatively charged carbon, then that's going to be pretty attracted to the carbonyl. And as soon as that attack occurs, they're not literally next door to each other. They're not neighboring by some bond connection, but in space, we end up with a positive and negative charge. They're very, very close to each other. And so although four-membered ring is not necessarily normally favorable, it's going to happen in this case. Now, there's this naming system that I don't even remember the name of the naming system. But it's very often used when describing what are known as heterocycles. So some terminology from last quarter, we have hydrocarbons, which are just compounds with hydrogen and carbon. And then there's the other atoms that functionalize hydrocarbons, oxygen, nitrogen, and so forth, that we call heteroatoms, because they're different than what's in a plain old hydrocarbon. By extension, a heterocycle is a cyclic compound in which one of the members of the ring itself has been substituted with something besides carbon. And that's what we have in this case. So in this nomenclature system, it can be sort of difficult to learn unless you use it all the time, because the prefixes or the names don't have any number terms. It's just different letters that are thrown in. And there is some pattern to it, but almost never shown at first year organic chemistry level. Reason for telling that long story is this does have an intermediate, the name of which is often in texts, and the name oxaphosphatane means a four-membered ring in which an oxygen and phosphorus is substituted. So oxa for oxygen, phospha for the phosphorus, the atane means four-membered ring. This oxaphosphatane is unstable and rapidly decomposes. Is one of the products that comes out is triphenylphosphine oxide, which is a very thermodynamically favorable product. Favorable meaning there must be some release of energy to make it, which is what drives this reaction forward. It is, like the borane reaction, one of the few four-centered transition states that you'll see. So it's a cyclic reaction. And the two products you get out are this byproduct, the triphenylphosphine oxide, which can be a pain to get rid of. But the other thing we get out is an alkene. And notice that that alkene is exactly the orientation that we made earlier by doing a Grignard reaction, followed by converting it to a leaving group, followed by a careful elimination. In this case, we just make the Wittig reagent, throw it in a ketone, and we're done. So that is the synthetic advantage of a Wittig reaction. So questions on the Wittig reaction itself before I turn to the lab? Yes? Oh, goodness. Yes, thank you. There we go. Other questions? So let's talk specifically about the set of reagents you're using in this lab. So, yes, this would be more directly lab notes. Well, except that from the other two sections, I could tell that we needed to review some common name nomenclature. So just a minute ago, I had told you that if benzene's being treated as a substituent, we use the word phenyl. So this could be called bromobenzene, or it could be called phenyl bromide. What does benzyl mean? One more carbon in between the substituent, whatever you're putting on there, and the main structure. So in other words, benzene ring with an additional carbon and then something hanging off of it. Benzyl groups are particularly reactive because it can form a primary carbocation. Reason is, when the bromine comes off, there's very extensive delocalization of the positive charge that's there. Every carbon on benzene is sp2 hybridized. If bromine came off, that carbon position would itself be sp2 hybridized. You'd have all this overlap between all of the atoms in that molecule, and so it makes an unusually stable carbocation. If we were to try to deprotonate at that position, that's also more favorable than normal because you end up having an anion that is delocalized, which if you can distribute the negative charge, makes it easier to form, makes the compound that it came from more acidic. And in a minute you'll see that's why we're able to use just sodium hydroxide in this lab. A couple of the common names, just because I know they're coming up in lecture soon. So if you don't remember, when you put something directly on a double bond, that's called the vinyl position. When you put it one carbon away, it's allyl. So phenyl and benzyl are kind of parallels with vinyl and allyl, in that the phenyl and vinyl refer to when you put something directly on the benzene ring or the double bond. And then benzyl and allyl are when you put it one position away. There must be some name for putting something directly on a triple bond, but I don't know it. I do know that you'll occasionally see one position away referred to as the aspargyl position. There are a couple other common names. I know that last quarter when you did your SN1, SN2 reaction, you had crotyl. That's often a common name as well. But we probably won't ever use that one again, so I'm going to stick to this set of five. And now that I've shown you that, let's look at the reaction you're doing today. So you start out with benzyl, triphenyl, phosphonium, bromide. Which has, as I was alluding to a moment ago, an unusually acidic proton. And I'll write out the structures momentarily, but it's due to resonance stabilization. So I forget what the pKa is. It's not super low. I think it's still above the pKa of water, but it's close enough that with a strong concentrated solution of hydroxide and heat and time, you're able to perform this deprotonation. Which will cover benzene chemistry very heavily soon. But one thing about benzene is it's not favorable to break up the benzene ring. But this resonance still does occur. And it is that delocalization that makes that position moderately more acidic. Oops. So, as far as the reaction that occurs, you're reacting this Wittig reagent made from the benzyl triphenyl phosphonium bromide with benzaldehyde. Now, does anybody in here happen to have an allergy to almonds? Well, good, because that means you all can do today's lab. Because if I understand correctly, if you have an allergy to almonds, you have an allergy to benzaldehyde. Does that mean you all suddenly have almond allergies? Yes. So, the Wittig reagent's going to attack the benzaldehyde. And you got to be careful when you write your intermediates, because in Wittig reactions, it's very easy to accidentally leave out a carbon. So just as a double check here, in the benzaldehyde, the thing being attacked, we've only got one carbon in between the benzene ring and the oxygen, and we've got that much at least in the product. We've got one carbon in between the benzene ring and the phosphorus. We've got that in the product, and we also have the bond that connects those two middle carbons. So I've done this correctly. We'll now form that oxyphosphatane. That happens right away. Zoom tight. But one thing I haven't written on here is what is the stereochemistry of the two benzene rings? Because depending on how the reaction originally occurred, once locked into the ring like this, maybe the two benzene rings are cis with each other. So they're both either wedges or both dashes. Or they could have been locked into the ring in such a way where one was a wedge, one was a dash. There'd be enantiomers of both cases, but once this compound forms, once the Wittig reaction's over with, we're going to have a double bond there anyway. So we won't have stereocenters, but... Good morning, Carolyn, class. Good morning, Carolyn. This will make sure that none of you are ever late again, right? I didn't tell this story in this class yet, did I? Or maybe it was yesterday's, and I already got that on yesterday's recording. I had a student once that was a good student, but a little bit of the jokester of the class. There's one day where he was late coming to class, and so I kind of looked at someone and said, "Do you have a cell phone number?
Yeah.
Could you dial it for me, please?"
Okay.
They picked up the phone. "Hello? Yes." Because he was still asleep. "It's Dr. Gray. Good morning." "Hi, Dr. Gray. Are you going to be coming?" The whole class was listening, so they were starting to just laugh, and he could hear it in the background. It's like, "Are you going to be coming to class today?" "I'll be right there." Anyways, back to serious now. So we have different configurations of these two benzene rings possible. Point being that once we do this formation of the double bond, there's going to be two products that result. Because if both of the benzene rings had been cis to each other, both wedges or both dashes, then you'd end up with a cis double bond. If the two benzene rings had originally been trans with each other, good morning, class. Good morning, Kathleen. Carolyn just got the same treatment. So, if the two phenyl groups had been trans to each other, the configuration of the double bond would also have been trans. I want to make sure to point that out because you have two different refluxes that you're supposed to be doing. The first one's actually kind of interesting because you're able to put both of the reagents into the reaction mixture at the same time. The benzaldehyde and the benzyl triphenylphosphonium bromide, which, by the way, cut everything into 1/3 quantities. Just so we're trying to conserve the reagent. I forgot to tell section one and I got yelled at because we're used to too much stuff. So 1/3 quantities for everything in the lab. But you're able to put both of those together because benzaldehyde and sodium hydroxide, there's no rapid reaction that happens just with those two reagents. The more likely thing that's going to happen is the deprotonation of the benzyl triphenylphosphonium bromide. which as soon as it forms, reacts with the benzaldehyde that's in solution. But to make sure you don't have some kind of strange side reaction, that's why you're adding the sodium hydroxide over a half hour time period. So yes, that means you have to sit there and only add it dropwise while trying to pretend that you're doing the lab, even though you're really going to be sitting there studying for your test as soon as I stop talking. Just make sure you don't add it in all at once. Do add it over the half hour period. But I don't want to influence which one of these products we make, because there's a second isomerization that you do after all the different washes and isolations that I'll mention in a second. Don't do that second part of the procedure. Don't do the isomerization. It's partly because of time, partly because I want to see what is the proportion of those two products that we get. Because we're going to analyze this by IR, which trans versus cisalkene, they have different vibrational modes, so we'll be able to tell the two compounds apart by IR. But we may make this the compound that we do, can I say it? NMR with, which yes, we'll start NMR again on Tuesday of next week when we come back to lab again. So new students, we did cover NMR theory last quarter. I would suggest that you go back to the lab notes that are still on the website for Chem 12A, review which topics that we did in theory, with theory, in NMR. Because this quarter, we're not going to do so much theory, we're going to do practical. We're going to take spectra and learn how to figure out what the compound structures are. And we're going to start doing that again after the exam's over, after we're back in lab on Tuesday of next week. So, save these compounds after you do your IR, because it may be the one that we do the NMR on this quarter. So, coming back to the procedure, though, I was talking about that first reflux. You're supposed to use a water condenser, but the other sections were able to get away with an air condenser. To anticipate the question half of you will ask, the boiling point of methylene chloride, which is also called dichloromethane, is about 40 degrees Celsius. The boiling point of the mixture is going to be slightly higher than that potentially, because if you have something dissolved in it, not just solids floating, but some of the dissolved, well, we have the boiling point elevation effect. So when it says to heat at reflux, what that means is to heat it up to the point where it's just starting to boil. It doesn't mean vaporize it. Don't heat it so much that it just all goes away. But heat it so you get a gentle boiling going on, which in your condensation tube, your condensers, that front, that upper limit of where the vapor reaches will start to crawl up that condenser. The vapor condenses, that solution then trickles back down into the flask. That process just keeps on going, and so it looks like a little miniature solvent waterfall going inside of there. And as the system gets hotter and hotter, it's potentially possible that that solvent front will rise. If it gets to the point where it gets all the way up to the top of your condenser, and if this is the air condenser, then we would have a problem, because that means the next step is for it to all just start evaporating out of the condensers. But neither section yesterday told me they had any issues using the air condenser. So either they did, but they knew how to handle it, so they didn't tell me, or I'm guessing they didn't have to use it at all. So it's just a lot more convenient to use the air condenser when possible. Well, for our labs, it's not so bad to use the water, but one fear in using water is leaks, because often when we do these reflux reactions, we do them for more than 1 hour. A lot of these reactions we do for half a day. Did I already tell you the story about the time where I was working at Berkeley, was a graduate student, had an undergraduate worker set up one of these things? If he forgot them or if they came off anyways, I don't know what. But we have hose clips to make sure that the hoses actually stay on the condenser, but one of them came off, and so the hose came off, and so water leaked all night and leaked down into the big named organic instructor that was down below our lab, whose office we got water into. I guess I didn't tell that story. So that's why I also try to avoid water refluxes whenever possible. It's also because for fume hood H8, there's a logistical issue where you've only got one water port for the two people sharing that fume hood. So if you have to switch to the water condensers, water always goes in the bottom and out the top, because you want the coldest part of the water stream to be right at where the reflux is occurring to make sure you trap as much solvent as early as you can. Now, that water might get warmed up as it goes up, but it still would hopefully be colder than whatever is condensing. For the H8 fume hood, since you only have one water connection, you'd have to take that, go into one of the condensers, come out the top of the other one, go in series into the next condenser's in port, let that come out the top, and then that goes into the sink. Right. Let's try and hope we get away with the air condensers. You're adding over half an hour, you're refluxing, it may turn different colors, you may get solids to form, it's gonna do different things because you've got an ionic byproduct that you're making potentially. So don't worry about the fact that the solution may not look nice and clear, because once you get to where you're doing your different washes, that will all change. You're gonna add in, what is it, water and methylene chloride after the reaction is done, which should form two different layers, an organic and a water layer. Methylene chloride, ooh, I didn't even say this to the other two sections, but I hope they did everything correctly. If your solution really does have methylene chloride, which layer is on top now? Oh, come on, 12A people. First lab we did last quarter, the different separations, the acid-base extractions, we used methylene chloride. Big, long speech about density and which layer is which. Methylene chloride is more dense than water, so it's going to be the lower of the two layers if it acts as the way I expect it to. So in most labs, you've been operating on the principle that when you do a wash, you drain out the bottom layer. That's not true now. You've got to drain out the bottom layer and save it because it's the organic layer. You've got to drain it out just so you can get to the water layer that you're going to throw away. So I hope sections 1 and 2 did it right. I guess they did. But you're going to add the water, you're going to add the methylene chloride. If they don't form two nice layers, add a little more methylene chloride, a little more water. Between the two of them, you eventually should be able to dissolve up whatever is left around. Do you then get rid of the water layer and begin your next wash? All right, so the next wash is sodium bisulfite, which is a reducing agent to get rid of the triphenylphosphine oxide, the byproduct. Should write that down, I guess, for lab quiz purposes. So in that wash, you'll add the solution. It'll be the top layer. You're going to mix it up, drain out, and keep the bottom layer. Then drain and throw away the top layer, which is the aqueous layer. If any stage you're unsure which layer is which, it should be obvious by the color. But you can also do the drop of water trick, where if it combines with the top layer, you know that the top layer is the water layer. If it plunges on through and it combines with the bottom layer, then you know the bottom layer is the water layer. And so in this lab, it should be the top layer where a drop of water would stop. You do that bicarbonate wash, and then you, no, not bicarbonate, bisulfite. And then you follow it up with another water wash, correct? So same thing, add the water in, shake it up, bottom layer keep, top layer throw away. You're then supposed to put it over a drying mixture, all right? Then you do a standard, depending on how much solvent you have, you could do a pasture filter FET, or if you had a large amount of solvent, you could potentially do a funnel filtration. One way or the other, you gotta get your drying agent out before you do the next step, which in your lab, the way it's written, is to just remove some of the solvent. And then you're supposed to continue on to the isomerization. But I don't want you to do the isomerization. So at that point, you're going to remove all of the solvent to isolate your solid product. And then you'll do IR and then save it potentially to do NMR. Reminder that you are supposed to be calculating percent yield. And so if you didn't do it for the first two labs, make sure that you're measuring your products for this lab. Which means, anticipating, The best way to do that is to measure the mass of the flask before you put the solution in to do the evaporation, because you can't scrape 100% of that compound out. Those of you who've had who haven't liked the different solids we've formed know there's, no matter how careful you try, always a little bit that ends up stuck in the flask. Well, if the only thing that's in there was your solid, then that's solved by measuring the flask first and doing mass by difference. That's called tearing your flask. So I recommend that you do it that way so you can get a better final mass of your product. Now, organic waste is back in H5. We've got this cart here now, so the poor people that are sitting at the front don't have to have the waste bottles always on their desk. But the acid and base waste are up at the front, the aqueous waste, that is. The organic waste is back in the back. The wash, the acetone bath, I know that thing gets nasty, but it does basically work, but it works a lot better if you make sure that the cap is left on, because the acetone evaporates quickly. So every time it's just left off, the solution evaporates, and whatever gunk is left in there gets more and more concentrated. So I'll take a look and make sure that the bath is in okay condition, but just please don't leave the cap off of that. Now, I got irritated by the other two sections yesterday because of the little sloppy things that happen when you all, well, for section one, they were in the same situation as you. They're just desperate for lab to be over so they can get the exam over with. And then section two, they just had the exam, so nobody felt like doing lab afterwards. But in section one, what did they do that just blew my mind? Something they did that I whined about. Oh! Left a bottle just sitting with the cap open, and I don't remember what compound it was this time, but still, I mean, I've whined about it enough times. You all are adults. You all are going to get fired from whatever jobs you get if you behave like that in whatever job you get, and I can't fire you, but it just drives me crazy that you can't be responsible enough to think of something that's not trivial. Maybe in the outside world and other professions, you don't have to worry about bottles, but that's the whole point. You're in a chem lab. It's a different set of rules. It's a different world in here. The other thing that after I told Section 2 about what Section 1 did, Section 2 did what all of the sections have been doing, which is the pipettes. Why is it okay to just leave a pipette with whatever might be in it, drip it all over the area over here? I got that 50% sodium hydroxide all over me yesterday cleaning it up because I didn't know what was there first, started cleaning up, and my hands were really slippery afterwards. Which, if you haven't ever heard that common sort of anecdotal thing about acids and bases, acids feel or taste sharp, bases feel or taste slippery. So if you've got slippery hands after today's lab, it's because you've got that concentrated hydroxide all over you. You've probably got pH 14 skin at that point. So that happened because I just cleaned up the area, just picked the stuff up and was manipulating it. That meant that they left that toxic and hazardous mess just laying around. Again, if you worked anywhere in an environment like that, you wouldn't work there very long. So this was on their recording. This is now on your recording. I'm not going to warn you all anymore. I'm just going to start marking down these types of things to figure out how many points to take off lab reports. Because you're in Chem 12B, I give this warning every quarter, I don't follow through, and if I don't follow through, then the behavior doesn't get corrected. So this is your absolute last warning, and from now on, when I see it, I'm just going to notify you all of what I've seen. I know that you got the test, I know that I've been a bit distracted this quarter. The fact that I might be a little bit in my own world, my own self, doesn't absolve you of your own responsibilities. It just means I better make sure that I'm looking out what you're doing. So don't get lazy in these little but important things. And it's as much me worried about your future as what you're doing in here. Because what you do now is what you're going to do on the outside. So we got to get that under control. Any questions about what to do for the lab? All right. For labs 1 and 2, do get this reflux in lab 3 going first. Whatever time you have left, deal with that. So since you don't have that 1 hour of reflux, I know you might have been hoping to have that to have more time to study and do your IRs. But at least get the reflux going, because you could always finish up lab 3 next week. Make sure you get at least to the Lab 1 IR, since that's the first of the lab reports that's due. And so you still have Tuesday even to do the IR for Lab 2 if necessary.